I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi there, this is Martina Navratilova.
Hi, I'm Mats Wilander.
Hi, I'm Andy Murray, and you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport from a rather damp and drizzly Roland Garros on day seven. It wasn't always damp and drizzly, but it was always a little bit damp and a bit grey and overcast and cool today. But the rain came in at around about 4 or 5pm and play was called off a couple of hours after that. And I am now stood in interview room three wearing a freebie Eurosport branded Pacamac, proving that television really is all glamour, standing alongside The Telegraph's tennis correspondent, Simon Briggs. Simon, how's your day been?
I'm just thinking that I'm actually wearing clothes that I've paid for, which is extremely unusual for me. I'm known for being the freebie king, going around wearing those Roland Garros t-shirts they used to give us.
The Eurosport are handing out Pacamacs like sweets, so if you want one of these numbers, of which there is a picture, I think, posted on our social media, trust me, you don't want one of these numbers.
I always want free clothes, doesn't matter how bad they are. I have no pride.
Okay, big words. You might yet see your tennis podcast recorded exclusively by people in Eurosport Pacamacs. In terms of the tennis, Simon, before the rain and the weather intervened, we've seen Andy Murray playing a little bit more like the world number one today, haven't we?
Yeah, it was another fascinating match. Andy Murray on clay, it seems to be it's a bit of a brain teaser every time, and there's plenty to talk about. And that was a remarkable first set. 83 minutes for the first set between Del Potro and Murray. 7 minutes.
Which you commentated on for BBC 5 Live and predicted before the match that it would be an 85-minute first set. Is that right?
No, I mean, I predicted that at about sort of 4-all or something when it was about sort of 54 minutes.
That's still not bad, Simon. Take the credit.
Yeah, well, I just had a funny feeling that they were both sort of throwing away gilt-edged opportunities. And you thought, they're just kind of freaking out because they're remembering all that pain and suffering that they went through playing 4 hours in Rio, then 5 hours in Glasgow, and knowing that this first set is just massive because, you know, if Murray had lost it, he probably would have been able to regroup. For Delpo, it was all too much, and he did this extraordinary thing that no one had ever seen before, of hanging on the net for 45 seconds. I think we timed him at the end of the first set with his head down. He wouldn't necessarily recommend it on a body language course. It was totally giving Murray every encouragement that he could possibly have wanted and telling him that basically you've done the job, now mate, just finish it off. Having said that, it was refreshingly honest anyway.
It was. He'd gone up to the net because he was querying the backhand down the line, which was called out, and it was very, very close. Carlos Bernardes came down from the chair. He actually sought guidance from the line judge who'd called it to make sure he got the correct mark. I'm sure he'd been watching what happened in Monte Carlo with Goffin and Nadal. You've got to get the right mark in those moments. It was confirmed to be out, and Juan Martín Del Potro just slumped over the net, didn't he? And as you say, stayed there for a long period of time. The camera held there while he was doing it, and I was watching the Eurosport coverage, and sort of after a while they had no choice but to go to a break. It looked like he might just stay there indefinitely and the ad break would never be slotted in. It was quite a bizarre moment, and Andy sort of admitted in press, didn't he, that he was asked directly, did you sort of smell the weakness there, did you smell blood and look to finish off the kill afterwards, and he sort of in as many words said, yes, I did.
Yeah, he still had some work to do. He was a breakup in the second, lost it when he served for it, and then won the next two games. So he didn't have to go through another tie break. But then in the third set, he won every game and finished on a run of eight successive games, as he did against Kuznetsov. And yeah, he was pretty pleased with himself. I mean, we've been saying all week, where is the match which is going to ignite Murray? I felt that Clizan was a big match for him, perhaps bigger than this one. But symbolically, this is his biggest win of the year, and he certainly sounded the most positive that we've heard him. And he didn't like it when I asked him about shushing himself either, did he?
He didn't like that at all, Simon. You're a braver man than me.
Well, we've just been following his kind of more wild-haired moments all week, all month on the clay. And today he just had a new development, because he did bark quite furiously late in the first set at his player's box. But otherwise, he kept on saying shh, shh, and sometimes even putting a finger over his own lips to tell himself that he wasn't going to start doing that stuff.
Plenty of players have done that sort of thing. Nick Kyrgios does it a bit to the crowd, doesn't he? Shoot, when they're booing him or whatever, depending on what his antics are. But a player shushing themselves, I think it's perfectly valid. It's bizarre enough behaviour that it's valid to ask about it, Simon. Consider yourself vindicated. Yes, I completely agree with you that he seemed to be buzzing after that match to me. Obviously, he had come down considerably by the time he came into press, but I did have the opportunity to speak to him on the court in the immediate aftermath for Eurosport, and this is what he had to say, confirming that yes, he does think it is the biggest match, the biggest performance of his clay court season so far.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, at times in the second and third set, I felt like I played some really good tennis. First set was a little bit patchy. I think he probably deserved to nick the first set. Second and third sets, I felt like I started to play better, dictating more of the points and getting a better look on the return games, and it was a good performance in the end.
Might sound ruthless, but you're expert at exploiting an opponent's weaknesses. For Delpo, that's the backhand and it's the movement. Was that the plan today?
Yeah, well, I think on the hard courts, I think he hasn't played much on clay the last few years, and the one thing that I've always found when I've struggled on clay is, or haven't played on it for a while, is the movement. And you know, on the hard courts, when he's moving out to his forehand side, he's so dangerous on the run. On the clay, when you're a little bit unstable on your feet, you know, and it's a bit slippy out there, it's tougher. So I was trying to open up the court to the backhand, get him moving into the forehand side, and it wasn't working at the beginning. I wasn't getting enough on my shots, but when I did start getting a better hit, it worked really well.
Your last two matches before this were absolute epics, 4 and 5 hours. During that 85-minute first set, were you starting to have flashbacks of the Olympics and the Davis Cup?
Yeah, and also, I mean, in these conditions, it's very difficult to finish the points quickly. It's very heavy out here today, much slower than it has been. So yeah, I mean, had I gone behind in that first set, it would have been tough. But I kept going, stayed on top when I got the chances, and thankfully finished it in straight sets. But it was looking like it was going to be a long one at the beginning.
We're very glad you did, Andy. Well done.
Thank you.
So that was Andy Murray speaking to me directly after that pretty convincing victory over Juan Martín Del Potro. I was struck in that interview, Simon. It seemed like, you know, when you do something that you're really proud of, or you think is really great, and you just want to talk to someone about it straight away. It was almost, I couldn't stop him talking. Usually in those interviews, they want to get straight off the court. You know, he had the bag on his back, which is always a sign that this isn't going to last long. But he was just brimful of energy and things to say about that match, and that for me is a very good sign.
Well, clearly it's all the sweeter when you come in under such a cloud as he had, and I'm sure that he used, you know, all those questioning articles and doubtful prognostications to...
Ooh, is that a word?
It is a word. To fuel his own turnaround, to make himself more dialed in his practice sessions. And there's a sense of a guy who's timing his charge at the right moment. I was looking at the stats as well. He's looking like he's had like 20% more winners than unforced, which is not that far out of line, even with Nadal, actually. Not far out of line with Wawrinka. Novak's way down on those measures. Not that you can read too much into it. Murray spent longest on court out of the four of the top seeds. But
nothing new there.
Yeah, 9 hours for 3 matches. probably still only the same as what the first two matches would have taken last year.
Exactly. He's still down in terms of his tally on last year. I asked him about that, actually, and asked him to compare how he was feeling at this point to the same point last year. And he was a bit fuzzy on it, but he basically said, yeah, I'm feeling physically better, form-wise, and mentally might be a different story, but physically he's feeling better. I also asked him, I got the impression in the press conference that he had very much adjusted his expectations upwards. He admitted that he had lowered them coming into the tournament than he usually would have at a Grand Slam because he was struggling so badly. And he was starting to talk. He used the word final and winning it. And I think I think he'd put all of those thoughts out of his mind a week ago. And I'm not saying he's thinking to himself, yeah, I'm going to win this thing. But I think he's allowing himself to think in terms of it being possible now.
Yeah, and you look at his draw and it's either Isner or Khachanov in the fourth round. They didn't finish because of the rain.
Khachanov was a setup. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you'd fancy him against either of those. And then the potential quarterfinal, should he go that far? Verdasco making a strong bid because who did Verdasco destroy today?
Cuevas. Pablo Cuevas. And he's been in great form this year.
Exactly. So, I mean, that was he dropped, what, six games? So that was a statement from Verdasco. But, yeah, Murray's got a very strong record against him too. And then you're thinking, can he get to the semis against Stan, which is what he did here last year? He said in the press conference he'd come in just trying to win each match and hope that he would find something. And clearly he has.
And speaking of Stan, we won't go into it in too much detail because neither of us were able to watch the match in any detail at all, really, because we were focused on what was happening on Chatre between Murray and Del Potro. But Stan Wawrinka had a pretty similar match to Murray against Del Potro. He was in trouble in the first set. Actually, Fabio Fognini served for it. Stan came back, won the set, and then cantered to the next two sets, probably even more so, perhaps not the six love set that Murray had in the third. But Stan, by all accounts, from what I've read, was in pretty dazzling form. And that's pretty good going for him in the first week of a slam. Usually he's very sluggish, struggles his way through, and then peaks in the second week, but he's looked great first week. So I don't know what that means. I don't know whether that means he's peaked too soon and he's going to be rubbish next week, or whether it means that this is an even more fearsome Stan Wawrinka than we've seen in the past. But anyway, he seems to be in great form at the moment. Somebody else that was in fearsome form, and I did watch a bit of this because the winner could have potentially played Carl Edmund. Alas, we will talk about that in a moment, Simon. But Marin Cilic, I think, is in some great form. I'm not saying he's going to win a clay court Grand Slam, but he is really feeling bullish about his chances of going deep here. I spoke to him after the match in anticipation of him playing Carl Edmund, who was 2-1 up Carl at the time. So we did a quick interview with Marin Cilic to preview that potential fourth round. And he said, this is so by far the best I've ever played on clay. He was really bullish about how he was playing. I was impressed with him. But he will play Kevin Anderson in the fourth round because Kevin Anderson was the 5-set victor over poor Carl Edmund today. What did he make of that one?
Well, Carl Edmund didn't seem too disheartened. I mean, the point was that it was 3 hours, 59 minutes, and he was strong at the end. And that's, in itself, the most encouraging day of his year in some ways. He's really had a physical problem going deep in 5-set matches in the past.
And that was the longest match he's ever played today against Anderson.
By a long way. I think it's 3 hours, 12 was his previous one against Damir Dzumhur, which he lost 6-1 in the fifth in Australia last year. So he seemed pretty chipper, and I would be too if I was him, because Kyle really knows about building blocks. I mean, I actually wrote my piece. The first thing I ever heard about Kyle was when he was at National Tennis Centre, which I think was then actually at Bisham Abbey, before it got moved to Roehampton. They used to notice that he'd go into a training block and he'd lose matches, because everyone loses matches when they're knackered. And he wouldn't care about it because he knew that he was concentrating on the training block, whereas his peers would get freaked out. He had this ability to work out what he needed to do next all the time, and he's piloted his way through his career in that same way. And he's going to be looking at that and thinking, Anderson played fantastically well. I looked at Anderson's stats in that fourth set, 12 winners, one unforced, when he got the fourth set 6-1 and retook the momentum. And Anderson's a former top 10 player. I mean, he only made top 10, so he's on the edge
of it. Yeah, but in real terms, he's pretty much a top 20 player, isn't he? But take away the injuries that he's experienced and the fact that he's on the comeback trail, he's really top 20, top 25, isn't he?
So I don't think anyone's really going to be crying over Kyle's results. People are going to be thinking this is another step towards what he's trying to deliver, which is a top 20 career, perhaps maybe, like Anderson, the odd moment in the top 10.
Yeah, I mean, they're not sexy, are they, the quotes that come out of a Kyle Edmund press conference? They're not, I mean, words like building blocks and taking the positives and momentum and growing and stuff, that they don't make for scintillating reading, but they do make for a very good tennis player, a tennis player that's going to maximise their potential. You do, it's what you want to see from him, that somebody as somebody that wants him to succeed, but as somebody that just in that moment wants, you know, a great interview, somebody going, oh, I was gutted to lose today. It's not the best, is it? But I do believe that in the wider scheme of things, that attitude will absolutely benefit Kyle Edmund. So Marin Cilic up against Kevin Anderson in round four. I'm not sure that's going to be a Philippe Chatrier match, if you get what I'm saying. I'm not sure that is going to be the most watchable of clay court matches. It's not going to be Nadal against Djokovic semi-final 2013, 2012? The one that went on before Tsonga, and then Tsonga came out all flat, Tsonga Ferrer.
Yeah, yeah,
when
yeah.
was that? 2012? 2013? Anyway, I don't think it's going to be that, but good luck to both of them. Just a quick look at the women's side of things before I let you go, Simon. Simona Halep negotiated a very tricky or potentially tricky clash with Daria Kazatkina today. 7-5, 6-love, or the other way around?
6-love,
7-5. Again, didn't get a chance to watch much of it because it was over on Longlen, but that to me looks like a very impressive scoreline. What I did see on the women's side of things, what did I see earlier? Well, Elise Cornet, that's what I saw, winning through very handily against Agnieszka Radwanska. I'm not sure what Radwanska is, what her game plan is on clay. She looks like she's just given up, really. She looks like, oh, this isn't my thing, move on, rather than giving it a go. But Cornet played a very good, it was a highly entertaining match despite the very one-sided scoreline, and she, Cornet, will now play Caroline Garcia, who's into the fourth round of a slam for the first time. Nobody was picking her to do anything coming in here because she has historically crumbled under the pressure of playing in front of the French crowd, and she's not alone there amongst French players. But there's quite a lot of beef between these two. I don't think they like one another at all. There have been some pretty spicy quotes coming out of both of their press conferences, and I think, Simon, it all stems from Garcia's decision to walk away from the Fed Cup team to exempt herself from selection. I know there's some beef between her and Mladenovic because they were a doubles partnership, and I don't think Garcia handled the breakup of that doubles partnership brilliantly. I think it's fair to say overall that Garcia has not enamoured herself with the other French players or French public. Do you think that's correct?
Yeah, whether it all starts with that is an interesting question, because My sort of understanding of the French women is that Garcia doesn't seem to be as provocative as Cornet, who is constantly getting herself in controversy. Nor do I think Garcia is as provocative as Mladenovic, who perhaps is less of a wild card on the court, but is prone to saying some quite...
She's pretty outspoken, isn't she? Yeah. She's articulate with it too, so people really sit up and take notice.
And people are beginning to interview Mladenovic just because they think she's going to say something pretty wild. So whether it all starts with the Fed Cup withdrawal from Garcia, I don't know. It's clearly, you know, the latest sort of spur for their disagreements. But yeah, the French women, they certainly do know how to do falling outs in spectacular fashion. And that's going to be a fascinating match to watch. I mean, also, I think they're both, all three of them indeed, are pretty damn good to watch. They had that classic sort of French repertoire of being able to do a lot of different things. Garcia is proper kick serve, which you don't see from many people outside of Sam Stosur and Sarah Arani. And Cornet is... she's just an agent provocateur, I suppose. That's the phrase I'm looking for.
It's very good of them all to give the French press here something to write about, isn't it? I mean, they are I'm sure, still typing away because, yeah, the quotes coming out of all of their press conferences are very interesting indeed. Just a quick look ahead to tomorrow, Simon. We don't have an order of play yet. The rain has rather scuppered us. In fact, now that I've mentioned rain, before we talk about the order of play, I should probably bring you some words from Mats Wilander, because there is one good thing about the rain other than my freebie Eurosport poncho, and that is that I was called upon to fill rather a lot of time of Eurosport rainy airtime with Mats Wilander earlier, and I was given the brief that I could talk about whatever I liked with Mats. So we just talked about tennis for ages on the telly. I couldn't believe my luck. And he was interesting on all sorts of topics. And this is what we talked about. Finally, we're seeing the real Andy Murray, aren't we? He was great today.
Yeah, he was. I thought I saw most of it, but I thought he played a few points in the tiebreaker that was really impressive. He served and volleyed a couple of times, 2 points in a row actually in a tiebreaker, and you don't want to lose the first set against Juan Martín del Potro because he likes to be the front runner. So what seemed to be risky to Andy Murray was a very safe play. It was something that he had decided, and in the end it worked out. So winning the first set, I didn't think it was going to be that important, but it seemed to Del Potro that it was really important for him to win the first set.
Yeah, an 85-minute first set. He told me after the match that he was starting to have horrible flashbacks of the matches he played with him at Davis Cup and, of course, at the Olympics. He did not want to be out there for 5 hours today, did he?
No, he didn't, but it's amazing how that matchup works, because Andy Murray, obviously, he loves to defend. Sometimes he might be a little bit too passive against certain players, but very few players can hang with Del Potro, allowing Del Potro to sort of dictate, and Murray just seems like that's his world. And then he throws in these sort of weird tactical changes like serving and volleying or the drop shot here and there. So a brilliant match. I thought already against Martin Kliesen, we were sitting there, I thought that something after that first set, something started to click for Murray. And right now, I think that the confidence that he has lost over the last few months, I think it's not that big a worry anymore.
Yeah, I've just come from the Andy Murray press conference, actually, and sometimes being in those is a matter of reading between the lines, and what I read between the lines was that he's starting to very much revise his expectations upwards of what he can achieve at this tournament. He came in trying to lower the expectations, trying to lower the pressure on himself, and now he's starting to think, hang on a second, I've just beaten Juan Martín del Potro for the first time in three sets. Maybe I could win it here.
Yeah, and I think once a player starts thinking like that, you know that the whole locker room has already started to think like that, if they ever thought that Andy Murray had lost his confidence. But yeah, the fact that he's saying that, and the fact that you can see it in his decision making on the court, and the fact that he goes through this match and wins 6-love in the third. Okay, Del Potro went away, but it doesn't matter. It's just such a good feeling, and you get so much strength from it. So I say that Andy Murray, watch out for Andy Murray. He doesn't mind his rain, does he? Because he is most probably used to it, just like all you Brits are.
Just makes us all feel so at home. Now, while Andy Murray was on court, we had over on Long Lens, Stan Wawrinka once again sneaking through the draw here. He's a former champion. How is he able to fly so far under the radar? He was extraordinary today against Fabio Fognini.
Oh, we're nearly taking off here, Catherine. I think that the talking points here has been the lack of motivation from Novak Djokovic, the lack of motivation from Andy Murray, Angelique Kerber a little bit, and of course Rafael Nadal is playing so unbelievably well. I'm sure the Swiss newspapers and that we're talking about Roger Federer not being here. So I think it's a natural thing that Wawrinka is flying under the radar. But I think once he gets to the second week, he's not going to be flying under the radar anymore. And he doesn't mind if it's this kind of weather. Well, he can't play in the rain. He doesn't mind the heavy courts. He doesn't mind when it's fast and fiery. So he is getting better and better and better. And so is Andy Murray. And so is Novak Djokovic.
Well, exactly. You actually caught up with Andre Agassi earlier on today. Great privilege for you. I know that's an interview that will hopefully be playing at some point in Eurosport. So I don't want to scoop it, but can you just give us the inside track on what he said?
Yeah, the inside track is basically to try and get Novak to to understand why he's playing, what the reasons are for being out in the court, take his opponent on. You know, that's where we're good. That's what great champions are good. Everybody can play when they're behind. Everybody can play, most players, when they're winning. They got some confidence. But it's that battle that you have to enjoy when it's 0-0. And you see Rafa Nadal come on the court. He is like a lion or a bull. He wants the confrontation. And I think Andre Agassi, he talked a little bit about the fact that he kind of lost it a little bit, but Brad Gilbert helped him sort of understand that tennis is not about just hitting, it's about the other person and about the battle and the confrontation. And so I think it sounds to me like Andre is trying to just get into Novak's head a little bit and have a conversation about what makes it fun to play tennis. And he also said, because it's not winning. And it certainly isn't losing. It's being in the present and just playing the guy that's in front of you. That's really what tennis is about.
That's very interesting, isn't it? Because over the past 6 months or so, the story of the tennis season has been about Rafa Nadal and Roger Federer and their resurgence. And one of the things that strikes me about them is how much they love tennis. In particular, Roger Federer. He can love tennis even when he's not winning. Whereas Novak Djokovic, over the past few months, he seems to have been not able to enjoy tennis unless he's winning. He loves winning, but he doesn't necessarily love tennis at the moment in the way that Roger Federer does. Do you think that is at the crux of what Agassi is going to try to instill in him?
I think so. I absolutely think so. And I think that there were times when Rafa Nadal didn't look like he loved tennis, maybe a couple of years ago when he lost to Novak Djokovic here. I don't know why Roger Federer didn't win a major for the last 5 years until the Australian Open this year. I think that the biggest difference between Rafa Nadal and Roger Federer and Novak and Andy is that they are much better at bluffing and they're poker players. And it's really difficult to tell if Rafa or Roger are not enjoying themselves or are not fighting at 100%, are not choking and are not flat. Whereas with Murray and Djokovic, you have this feeling that you can tell they wear their emotions on their sleeve. And I think the players eat that up. Their opponents eat it up. I think we in the media, we sort of look, oh, look, he's flat or he's this or whatever. And Roger and Rafa are so good at that. At the same time, as you're 100% correct, they love tennis more than anything, I think, Rafa and Roger. And the confrontation is fine every day, all day, no problem.
And he's found himself a coach now whose autobiography started off with the words, "I hate tennis. I hate it. I hate it with a burning passion." He had to find a way to try and fall in love with tennis. So he's the perfect guy.
Oh, it's perfect. And he won. And I asked him about that, actually, because he won the career Grand Slam here in Paris in 1999, coming back from 2 sets to love down.
Same year here, he and Steffi got together. Big year for Andre Agassi.
Could that have something to do with the inspiration that he told me he found? When he won the career Grand Slam, he found a new inspiration. And then, of course, he won 4 more majors into his 30s. It sounds like Novak Djokovic is trying to imitate the career that Andre Agassi had, because Djokovic is in the same situation right now and he's missing some of the motivation. And I think Andre is absolutely the perfect person for Novak.
And he seems to be absolutely loving it as well, doesn't he? Considering everybody thought it was completely out of the question that Andre would take a coaching role in tennis. You know, he's really taken a back seat from tennis since he retired. We haven't seen much of him. Everybody thought he and Pete Sampras, no, there's no way they'll ever want to be on the tour again. Do you think that Pete Sampras is looking at what Agassi is doing with Djokovic and thinking, hang on a second, I might like to have a little go at that?
Hopefully, because surely Pete Sampras would be most probably a great coach. He could share his stories. I think he has to find somebody who plays a similar game to him. How about Nick Kyrgios, for example? So yes, it would be good. The one thing that Andre said that really sort of stayed with me is, you got to love what you do. That's everybody says that. And you got to love what you do. There is something in life that you love to do. And in most tennis players' case, it's playing tennis. It's that confrontation. And when you don't love it anymore, it's normal. Because I was flat when I was number one in the world. John McEnroe suffered from it. Pete Sampras quit at 31, was flat a few years before. So, and he said, not everybody comes out of it. Some people find something else that they're in love with. Could be your family, could be golf for Pete Sampras. But you got to sort of naturally do what you love to do. And not everybody's able to get back because they don't have that love. So I think that's what he's trying to get Novak Djokovic to think about, to find, help him find, and help him with, you know, tactics and whatever.
And what we love to do, Mats, is standing in the rain, talking about
tennis. Oh, I love it. Isn't it good?
One more question while I've got you. And it's a pretty tricky one because obviously we've got one heavy standout favourite in the men's draw this year in the form of Rafael Nadal, losing just one game yesterday, one game that you thought he actually gave away to Nicolas Basilashvili. And who am I to argue with you? Are there any dark horses that you've seen over the course of the last week that you think could do some damage, trouble a top seed, maybe even get to the semis or final?
I think that if you can call Dominic Thiem a dark horse, I think he is a dark horse. I think that Karen Khachanov, a Russian who beat Thomas Burdick in three straight sets.
A possible next opponent of Andy Murray, we should say he's been called off because of these conditions, because of the rain. He led a set to love over John Isner, so it's a very good shout.
Yeah, I don't know if these guys can win the tournament. I think Dominic Thiem could potentially win the tournament, but there is a lot of guys out there that can beat the top players, that can even beat Rafa Nadal. Yes, there is. Stan Wawrinka can beat Rafa Nadal. If it's a day like this when it's heavy, Novak Djokovic could potentially do that too. So I think that Rafa is not looking necessarily at winning yet. And I think the other guys know that he's the favorite and they're afraid of him, that's for sure. But the longer the tournament goes, the bigger the chance is that the other guys have more confidence than they had going into the tournament.
And especially as long as this rain goes on. Rafa Nadal, poor thing, it's his birthday today. It's his 31st birthday. He won't be enjoying seeing this weather out of the window. He'll be doing some sort of rain dance to make sure it clears up as soon as possible because he likes the sun, doesn't he?
I think he's doing a rain dance because Real Madrid is playing against Juventus and he is not going outside today.
Yeah, but football players, they're hardier than tennis players, Mats. They will play through all of it. Thank you so much for keeping me company, holding the umbrella up for me and talking tennis with me in the rain, Mats.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
So that's Mats Wilander. Interesting as always, even in the rain. Very good of him to hold an umbrella over me throughout the duration of that interview. What I wanted to pick up on is what he was saying about his interview with Andre Agassi that he did earlier. I haven't seen the full interview, it's embargoed, but he did leak us some of the highlights there. And what I'm particularly interested in, Simon, is the fact that he said that he thinks Novak Djokovic is going to dominate tennis again as a result of his discussion, his interview with Andre Agassi that he did earlier. He became convinced, not that Djokovic would win Grand Slams again, because I think there's a lot of feeling that Djokovic will win Slams. He said he heard enough to be convinced that Djokovic will dominate tennis again. Simon Briggs, everyone, has eyebrows raised as high as they can go.
Yeah, I guess because Djokovic hasn't turned a corner this week, has he? But I'm not privy to the interview, so whatever devastating...
I have to say, he didn't say it that strongly in the interview. He sort of said it afterwards. He came back, she spoke to him just after he came back from that interview, and he's really buzzing from it. He said he's just generally buzzing about tennis, isn't he? He just loves it so much. But he was really won over by what Agassi had to say about their partnership, and he really... I don't know, it's like Agassi performed some kind of hypnosis on him. He suddenly just... He was completely convinced about what Agassi could do for Djokovic.
Yeah, I guess Mats and Andre probably have a language that they might have some concepts in common. The sort of spiritual side of the game being quite close to their hearts now.
I genuinely don't know. I don't know Andre at all. My guess is the fact that he's got on board with the Pepe Imaz situation suggests that he would have to be. Do you think he's not necessarily on board with that?
Well, because I haven't seen this interview, but I did see the L'Équipe piece. They did about 3 pages on an Andre interview, which I felt a bit jealous about because I wasn't given an invitation to talk to him.
And I don't know what the criteria are for being invited to speak to Andre Agassi. I wasn't invited either, Simon, if that makes you feel better.
Well, I've got a Carlos Moya interview in tomorrow's Sunday Telegraph, so that's I'm holding on to that.
He's been pretty punchy, actually, this week on Rafael Nadal. I imagine he gave you some good stuff, actually.
Yeah, I mean, we just talked about the technical improvements they've made, and he certainly feels that he's playing top ball, but then that's not really in any doubt, is it, after the way he steamrolled through the first week.
You say that, but again, I'm sorry to hit you with all these things that Mats Wilander said to me in an interview you haven't heard, but Mats thinks he's beatable. He thinks he's beatable by Stan Wawrinka, crucially.
Yeah, I mean, if Novak beat Rafa, I would be absolutely stunned, wouldn't you, this week?
I would. Froome McMillan said he thought it was possible in yesterday's podcast. And look, who am I to disagree with Froome McMillan? But I've not heard anybody else saying that. I asked him whether he thought Novak would have been quaking in his boots having watched if he had seen any of Nadal's performance in the locker room yesterday, because obviously he was coming out straight afterwards, and Froome said no, that their recent head-to-head would sort of override that in his mind and give him a confidence that couldn't be counteracted by any one brutal performance as it was from Nadal yesterday. But anyway, we digress. I can't even remember what I asked you. Have you anything else to say about tennis, Simon?
Well, I'm just going to reference my one moment of predictive inspiration today, that we did the graphic on the Andy Murray drop shot in the Telegraph.
And
he murdered Delpo with it.
Is this a graphic that translates on a podcast in audio form? Can you explain it?
Well, we just had he's hitting the backhand drop shot from his own backhand corner, and he's hitting it up the line, and he hasn't missed one in the entire tournament. So he's not won every single point, because occasionally they go a little bit too close to the service line, and sometimes the player's on top of it. But his backhand drop shot up the line from his own backhand corner has not missed once the entire tournament.
And what conclusions do we draw from that?
That it's a regular supply of points, you know, because he's got like a 65% winning percentage on it, which is big. And he used it today when he was in trouble. He used it in the first set tiebreak, I think, on the penultimate point. And it was just a massive factor for breaking up the sort of the punching baseline showdown in which he was never going to be able to match Delpo's unbelievable velocity off the forehand side.
I hope Brad Gilbert wasn't watching. Do you remember how much Brad Gilbert used to hate Murray doing all his drop-shotting?
But hasn't that been a massive factor in his mastery of clay in the last 3 years? And maybe we give Amélie Mauresmo some credit for that, because she's one of those sort of touch variety players. It does feel like he's dropped better since he was working with her. Whether it was her who actually helped him with it, I don't know. It might just have been an attitude thing. The clay court sequence actually really began with Jonas Bjorkman in Munich, so goodness knows who had input into it anyway.
I mean, Alex Correcho could have, I'm sure, have had some input as well. I mean, he's had plenty of people giving him input over the years, hasn't he?
But the drop shot's gone from being a liability in the Brad Gilbert days to being a huge asset in the last 2-3 years.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that audio diagram of a visual metric of drop shotting. I think it was pretty well explained, actually, Simon. Thank you very much. If you want to see the real life visual thing, check it out in the Telegraph and on Simon's Twitter. Wow, it's everywhere, Simon. Wow. He really is pleased with this. He's like Andy Murray in his post-match interview with me. This is his Juan Martín Del Potro moment. So do check it out, please. And do check out that Carlos Moya interview in the Telegraph tomorrow as well. Do watch the Eurosport coverage. We promise no rain tomorrow, just simply because I don't ever want to have to wear this Packamack again. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you're enjoying these daily French Open podcasts. We'll be back with you tomorrow with another French Open podcast brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.